interested him. So, I guess we shall simply have to see. No man knows how long he has to live anyway, right? Justine couldn't have guessed she would live for almost a century. It's just the way things are. And one has to deal with it as best one can. Mary, Diana, and Alice went to St. Marylebone Church. Beatrice and Justine, who were Catholic, went to St. James's Church, across from Spanish Place. Mrs. Poole said she would go to an afternoon service. Catherine sat up in her room, opened a notebook, and started writing.
No man who has seen Astarte has lived to tell the tale but one. I, Rick Chambers, Englishman.
Yes, she thought. That sounds just right. By the time Mary returned with Diana and Alice and Beatrice and Justine returned together, Mrs. Poole had prepared Sunday lunch. So we all sat around the large table in the dining room, since the morning room table was too small. It would become our room for club meetings and plotting strategy. But that day we were eating creamed ham, Catherine and Diana, cauliflower soup, Justine and Mary, and something wilted, Beatrice. And we were making plans. How could we live together? What would we live on? We all thought of ways to make money. Beatrice would sell her medicines. Justine wanted to try painting. Catherine would write. Diana wanted to become an actress, but no, said Mary. Being an actress wasn't respectable, and anyway she had to go to school, as did Alice.
I just want to be a housemaid, miss, said Alice. I almost died, remember?
I would rather not almost die again, if you don't mind.
Mary had insisted she eat with us, rather than in the kitchen. She was picking at the ham.
Well, we can't afford school fees anyway, and I suspect that sending Diana to school would be a disaster, said Mary. So we can educate you both at home. Beatrice can teach you science, and Catherine can teach you literature, and Justine can teach you French and Latin. And I used to be rather good at history. But what can I do to bring in some money? I have no artistic talents. I could be a shop girl or typist, but I've already tried all the agencies.
How about becoming my assistant?
We all looked up, startled to hear a masculine voice. There in the doorway of the dining room stood Sherlock Holmes.
I'm sorry, miss, said Mrs. Poole. He didn't wait for me to announce him, just strode in here.
Forgive me, Mrs. Poole, said Holmes. I'm afraid I have rather urgent news. You see, Hyde has escaped.
From Newgate? Said Mary.
She looked astonished, as well she might.
From the depths of Newgate itself. And I assure you that he was well guarded. This morning the warden found the lock picked and the prisoner gone. Has he tried to contact any of you?
We all shook our heads.
I don't suppose Renfield has escaped as well? Asked Mary. That would be a bit too much.
No, said Holmes. I telegraphed this morning to make certain. He's safely locked up, according to Joe Abernathy, who's been rehired at the asylum. I suspect Dr. Seward heard of my visit to Joe and wants to keep an eye on him. The good doctor looked at the both of us suspiciously when I returned his madman yesterday afternoon, after I assured Lestrade that he was not complicit in the murders. As of this morning, Renfield was in his room at the asylum in a straitjacket. Only Hyde was gone. Lestrade is alerting the ports, and if he's seen, he will be arrested. However, he managed to escape the first time, and I suspect we have seen the last of Mr. Hyde for a while. I'm sorry.
He looked at Mary with concern.
I know this must be a blow to you. You wanted to question him, and there's no possibility of claiming any reward in his absence.
And what of Mr. Prendick? Asked Justine.
Catherine looked away. If there was any information on Prendick, she did not want to know, although she knew Justine was asking for her.
Lestrade is also having his boarding house watched, although if Prendick has any brains at all, and I suspect he does, he won't return there. What he did is not technically a crime. There is no statute on the law books forbidding the creation of beast men. but I wager he does not want the Alchemical Society to get wind of his activities. He was clearly hiding them from Dr. Seward. When Seward summoned him, suspecting that he was somehow implicated in the murders, Prendick denied any knowledge of them. I wager he does not want the Society to know he was involved with the likes of Edward Hyde and Adam Frankenstein.
Prendick is gone. I'm sure of it, said Catherine.
He's a coward.
He's always been a coward.
Well then, said Holmes, where does that leave us? With Adam Frankenstein dead and the Beast Men destroyed, but Hyde and Prendick still on the loose. Although that orangutan may have gotten away as well, I'll tell Lestrade to keep an eye out for him. It may be difficult to press charges against Mrs. Raymond now, since there's no direct evidence of her involvement. I was counting on Hyde to testify against her. However, I've told Lestrade to keep an eye on her, and of course he will continue the search for Hyde. He can't take credit for having solved the Whitechapel murders without a murderer, preferably behind bars.
But Mr. Holmes, said Mary, while these two men have escaped, there is also the Société des Alchimistes itself. It is secret and unscrupulous in its methods. We may have solved the Whitechapel murders, but the mystery of this society remains. Who are its members? What does it do? Is it continuing the experiments that created Beatrice and Catherine? Surely this mystery is not yet solved.
Mary,
I like how neatly you have us talking, when really, of course, it was a babble of, do you think they'll catch him, and I bet he's headed back to Switzerland, and can I have more ham? I'm still hungry.
I agree, said Holmes. I have not forgotten about the society itself. It has been operating in England for, well, we don't know how long. And here in London, or at least it was, while Jekyll was conducting his experiments. London is my city. If there is a secret organization in it, I want to know what it's doing.
His face, as he said this, was grim. And what did you mean just now when you said I should become your assistant? Mary was almost afraid to ask. Surely he did not mean that she would be another Watson, solving mysteries with him, travelling around England as a detective? Well, detective's assistant, but still, after all, she had helped solve the Whitechapel murders.
I mean that I need someone to organise my papers. You've seen yourself that at present they are in disarray. I know where everything is, of course. But I need someone with a clear and logical mind, such as you have, to devise an organizational system that will make all my files easily accessible. It's clerical work, but you asked for work, and I have some for you. Are you interested, Miss Jekyll? I can offer £2 a week.
Mary put her soup spoon by her plate. She aligned it precisely, then folded her napkin beside it. We already knew her well enough. At least, Catherine already knew her well enough to see that she was disappointed and not showing it.
Justine. I knew it also.
Beatrice.
And I.
Diana.
I thought she always did that, just because she's Mary. Doesn't Mary always do that?
Yes, thank you. I should be very glad of £2 a week. When would you like me to start?
Today, if possible, said Holmes. I need to get back to Lestrade as Scotland Yard, and I would like you to accompany me, as a temporary Watson, to take notes. In Watson's absence, I lack a reliable secretary. Of course, he doesn't think of himself that way, but his notes are often useful to me, before they become the melodramatic stuff of his stories. If you're done with your meal, will you come?
Of course, said Mary.
Scotland Yard?
Well, she might be stuck in 221B Baker Street tomorrow, but today at least she was going somewhere interesting.
And how is Dr. Watson?
Asked Beatrice.
Much better this morning, said Holmes. I saw him first thing before meeting with Lestrade. You may visit him if you like, but I suggest no more than two of you at a time. I hope you won't be offended if I say that all of you together can be overwhelming. Particularly for a man in his delicate state.
I'd like to go see him, said Beatrice.
I'll go with you, said Catherine, for protection.
Thank you, Cat. And of course you're welcome to come with me, but I think I can protect myself.
Beatrice looked as though her pride had been wounded. Not to protect you. To protect the British public from you. Particularly until you become less poisonous. I can already see the headlines. Italian beauty poisons Londoners. The newsboys would be crying it all over the city.
And what about me? Asked Diana. I want to go somewhere or do something. Why don't I get to do anything?
Diana, will you stay with me? Said Justine. I am not yet entirely recovered, and if any danger were to threaten, if Hyde were to return, for instance, I'm not sure I could defend myself, or Mrs. Poole and Alice. We would need someone as clever and resourceful as yourself on our side.
Oh, well, if you need me, I suppose I can stay.
Diana shrugged, but looked as pleased as a cat that had gotten into cream.
Mary was not sure she approved of Justine's manoeuvre. Surely that sort of praise was bad for Diana, but at least it would keep her from following one of them without permission.
Well then, said Holmes, let's be off on our various errands. Miss Jekyll, if you're ready.
Yes, said Mary. Yes, I'm ready.
She rose from the table and pushed back her chair.
Let's go. It would be an adventure, and perhaps not the last.
Mary, of course not the last. Think of all the things that have happened since then.
Catherine, yes, but I have to end with at least a little suspense.
Mary,
what about what happened after that? You know, immediately after. You were all there.
Just a moment, Mr. Holmes, said Mary. I've forgotten my umbrella.
They were already outside the door of 11 Park Terrace, I mean, the Athena Club. It was a late spring day in London, which meant it was about to rain. Mary had indeed forgotten her umbrella. She did not add deliberately, because she had to know. Holmes nodded and she ran back inside. Catherine and Beatrice had their coats on, well, her coats, their coats now. Justine and Diana were standing in the hall, seeing them off. Quickly, because she did not want Holmes to come back in and hear her, she said, Diana, where is that pin you used to pick the locks in the warehouse? The hat pin you probably stole off my dressing table.
Diana looked at her with astonishment.
What hat pin?
You know perfectly well what I mean. Tell me the truth.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
Diana shook her head, eyes wide, all innocence. Which meant, of course, that she was lying. We were beginning to know her now, to know each other. We could tell things about each other that others would not be able to. That's how it is with families.
You gave it to him, didn't you?
Mary spoke accusingly.
Well, he's our dad, whether you want to admit it or not.
Diana crossed her arms and looked petulant.
So you did. I knew it. As soon as I heard he had escaped from Newgate, I wondered what he could have picked a lock with. Small enough to hide from the guards. You must have slipped it to him before you ran off with Charlie when he was already in handcuffs. It's your fault a criminal has escaped from prison. It's your fault a man who is dangerous to the public and potentially to all of us is still out there. Don't you realize? It was his watch fob in Molly Keane's hand. Adam wasn't a member of the society. He might have killed her, but your father was just as responsible for her death. He was probably the one who cut out her brain with a scalpel. Do you even understand what you've done?
Mary took her umbrella from the stand as though she might run Diana through with it. And he may have caused my mother's death, she did not add.
That was not something she wanted to discuss. Not yet. Instead, she added, although it felt irrelevant now,
It's your fault we lost even the possibility of a reward for finding the murderer of Sir Danvers Carew. He's our dad, said Diana.
She looked utterly immovable. which is how we have learned Diana often looks. Mary glared at her for a moment, then made the sound a lady makes when she is thoroughly angry. It's a sort of low growl. Clutching her umbrella like a sword, she walked out the door into the rainy London afternoon. Mary, do you know what Mr. Holmes said to me in the cab? Miss Jekyll, I know you and your friends haven't told me everything. I won't inquire into your secrets beyond what is necessary for me to solve the mystery of the Société des Alchimistes. They are safe even from me. Beatrice, that shows he is a gentleman. Catherine, it shows he'd already guessed what we weren't telling him. After all, he's Sherlock Holmes, and he wanted Mary to understand that he could be trusted. Haven't you noticed how he is around Mary? Do you seriously think he needed an assistant to organize his files? He wanted to keep her close, that's what he wanted. For more reasons than one, I'm guessing. Mary, why would he want that? Anyway, his files were a complete mess. With the organizational system I devised... Catherine, oh, please. Chapter 21. The Letter from Austria. It was August, 3 months after the night we had decided to live together at 11 Park Terrace. We were sitting in the parlour with the windows open to let in any breezes that might be flitting around the stagnant streets of London. The weekly meeting of the Athena Club was about to start. The parlour did not look the way it had 3 months ago. Justine had painted it yellow, and there was a band of flowers around the top of the wall, close to the ceiling. That had been Beatrice's idea. She insisted we must do away with the darkness and drab of previous centuries. We must have beauty and light. Also, she liked flowers. So we had yellow and green and blue walls, and the furniture had been recovered in Indian fabrics, and there were Japanese porcelains on the mantelpiece. She had bought them cheaply at a church rummage sale. She and Mary argued about the expense, but since Beatrice brought in more money than the rest of us, it was only fair that she should spend some on fabric and porcelain if she wanted to. We had to admit that we rather liked her taste, so we let Beatrice decorate and try to talk us into supporting the labour movement, aestheticism, and rational dress. Mary retorted that we were conspicuous enough without dressing differently from everyone else, but she had bought a bicycle. Mrs. Poole was scandalized. Those 3 months had brought certain changes to our household. Justine talked more, although it was usually about the meaning of life. We tended to stop listening when she said Rousseau or Kant. Surprisingly, Diana was the one who listened to her most often. Sometimes she even tried to read Justine's books, although we had seen her curled up on the sofa with her head uncomfortably pillowed on the Critique of Judgment. We had taken down the walls between the servants' rooms on the third floor, and Justine used that space as a studio. The entire third floor smelled of turpentine. She particularly liked to paint flowers and children and pastoral scenes. Catherine was working on her first novel, and two short pieces of hers had been published in Lippincott's monthly magazine. During the day we often heard the click-clack of her typewriter. Beatrice's plants had taken over the laboratory, spreading over the tables and up the walls. Except for Justine, we only went in there briefly, because the air itself had become poisonous. It would make you start to feel faint, and eventually you would lie down and die. But nothing could harm Justine, so she visited Beatrice whenever she liked. Every weekday morning, Mary walked across the park to assist Sherlock Holmes. She had, to her great pleasure, participated in solving several mysteries. In the case of the missing finger by Dr. John Watson, published in The Strand, she had even been described as a young woman of prepossessing appearance. We were worried that Watson, whose wound had almost completely healed, had developed a secret passion for Beatrice. Whether it was requited or unrequited, we did not know. Beatrice, don't be silly. He has always been simply a good, kind friend.
Diana continued to be a trial to us all. We were considering poisoning her with one of Beatrice's concoctions. No, not really. Although Catherine swore that if Diana used her typewriter and messed up the ribbon one more time, she would bite that girl through the throat. Just wait and see. Diana.
I would have liked to see you try. You were so annoying, always moaning about how difficult it was to write a novel. And look at you now, Miss Author.
Catherine. The first one was hard, almost as hard as this one. Alice continued to insist that she was only a housemaid and not at all interested in adventures, thank you very much. But she was getting particularly good at Latin, almost as good as Beatrice, and Mrs. Poole was still Mrs. Poole. She would probably never change. Mary.
She never has. She's still the same Mrs. Poole she's always been, only more so.
Since his escape from Newgate, we had not heard of or from Hyde. We assumed he had made it to the continent, where he could stay hidden for years, if necessary. Prendick had disappeared as well. To Lestrade's consternation, the Whitechapel murders were still considered unsolved, and learned men wrote treatises advancing possible solutions, all of them wrong. We continued to investigate the Société des Alchimistes, although we had not yet found out as much as we would have liked. Our investigations were ongoing. It was Saturday, the day of our official club meeting. We were all sitting on the sofa, or in the armchairs, except Diana, who sat cross-legged on the floor. Even Beatrice was sitting in an armchair rather than by the window, since she was less poisonous now. Diana.
She's still poisonous enough.
Mary was presiding. She usually presided over our meetings, although we had no official club president. But she was the best at organizing and keeping us all from talking over one another. As usual, our first order of business was finances. What had we made that week? Mary, £2. Justine, £10 from a commissioned portrait. This was not a usual sort of payment and could not be counted on again, but two of her paintings had been accepted into a gallery in Soho. Beatrice, £5, 7 shillings. Catherine, nothing. She had already received an advance for the novel she was writing and had no magazine sales to report. Diana, nothing yet. She was trying to persuade Mary that she should become an actress. If Mary would just let her appear at the Alhambra. Yes, the girls showed their legs, but so what? We allocated 10 minutes for Diana's argument and 1 minute for Mary to say no. That made a grand total of £17, 7 shillings for the week. Not bad, much better than we had been doing at first. It was difficult feeding 7 mouths and maintaining a large house, but we were managing. Second order of business. What had we learned about the Alchemical Society? Catherine, who sometimes wrote in the British Library reading room, had found mentions of the Society in 18th century manuscripts. The Society had been less secretive then, and many prominent Englishmen were members, but so far she had found no information on what experiments, if any, they had been conducting. She would continue her research. Mary reported that Dr. Seward was still in Purfleet. Joe, who was watching Seward for us, had told us he was planning on going to Vienna again, but at the last minute the trip had been cancelled. Why had Seward cancelled his trip? We did not know. It was frustrating knowing so little. 10 minutes for complaints about how little we had discovered so far. Beatrice said it was natural for our investigations to go slowly. Third order of business. Mrs. Poole had found 2 stray kittens in the backyard. What should we call them? The names Alpha and Omega were proposed and unanimously approved.
We had kittens!
Mrs. Poole insisted she was letting them stay only because they would eventually catch mice. Fourth order of business. Mary said,
I received this letter yesterday. You remember I said there was one person in the world to whom I could recount the events that brought us together? That person was my former governess, Miss Murray.
I wrote her a letter several months ago, not knowing she had moved. My letter seems to have been forwarded from address to address, but it finally reached her and she has written back. I think I'd better read you her response.
We waited, wondering what the letter was about, knowing Mary would not have told us about it if it were not important. She started reading.
My dear Mary, I'm sorry it's taken me this long to respond to your letter. As you can see from my address, I am no longer teaching school in England. To explain why I am in Vienna would take much longer than I have at present, for I, too, have been living an adventurous life, sometimes too adventurous for my taste. It has, strangely enough, intersected with yours, in a sense. You will perhaps understand more when you read the enclosed. If I were in a position to help the writer, who is the daughter of a dear friend, I would. But I need to leave Vienna almost immediately. I told her that if she wrote to you, I would forward her appeal. It is the most that is currently in my power. I hope, I very much hope, you can help her. And forgive me for my brevity. I will write more when I can. My love to you now and always, and I think you need no longer call me Miss Murray. Mina.
And, said Catherine, what is the enclosure?
Mary stared at a second sheet of paper folded in the first, as though trying to decide what to do with it. But really she had already decided, or she would not have brought it to our meeting. She began. Dear Miss Jekyll, our mutual friend Miss Murray has told me who you are, and of the Athena Club. You do not know me, but I take the very great liberty of asking you to help me in my dire need. I am the daughter of Professor Abraham von Helsing, a doctor and researcher associated with several important universities in England and on the continent. My father is also a prominent member of a certain Société des Alchimistes. Miss Murray has assured me that you know of this society, and that you and your fellow club members are aware of its activities. I am, against my will and sometimes without my knowledge, the subject of certain experiments carried out by my father. As a result, I am changing, and I am afraid. The one person who could protect me, my mother, is locked away in an asylum for the insane. I am not yet of age, and have no resources of my own or friends to whom I could turn. I do not know what to do. Please, if you can, help me, I beg of you. Lucinda van Helsing, Vienna, Austria.
For a moment we were all silent. Then,
where's Austria? Asked Diana.
We wanted to know if they were still making monsters, said Catherine. I think we have our answer. The Société des Alchimistes, or at least some of its members, are still experimenting on girls. Lucinda van Helsing doesn't tell us how.
She may not know herself, said Justine. This Professor van Helsing must be stopped. We cannot allow such experiments to continue. I speak only a little German, but could learn quickly, I think. Austria is near Switzerland, said Beatrice. I stayed in Vienna briefly, trying to find a cure for my condition. The nights will be getting cold there, although the days are warmer and sunnier than in London. We shall have to pack sweaters and wool coats.
I'll have to ask Mr. Holmes for some time off, said Mary.
I think he can survive without an assistant for a while. But this isn't the sort of thing we can rush into. It must be planned carefully. Has anyone seen the Atlas?
I was using it to plan Rick Chambers's escape route, said Catherine. I'll bring it into the dining room. Meet me there in 5 minutes.
You're not going to leave me behind, said Diana. You're always leaving me behind.
And then we sat around the large mahogany table, Mary, Diana, Beatrice, Catherine, and Justine, mapping travel routes, calculating expenses, planning the future adventures of the Athena Club. Author's note. Mary refuses to listen to me, but I am, after all, the one writing this story, with frequent interruptions. So I'm going to add a note about Mrs. Shelley, also named Mary, and the book she is most famous for writing, Frankenstein, a biography of the modern Prometheus. We authors have to stick together, even when one of us is long dead. Those of you who are interested only in adventures may wish to ignore this part and go directly to reading one of my other books. I won't mind. Mary says the book is a pack of lies, and accuses Mrs. Shelley of writing it to protect the Société des Alchimistes, as it was constituted in her time. After all, she never mentions the society. She implies that Frankenstein was working entirely unguided and alone, which was not the case. Most readers nowadays assume the book is a work of fiction anyway, as Watson did, but it's not. Neither is it entirely lies. The early story of Victor Frankenstein is almost entirely accurate, as we know from Justine. Mrs. Shelley fails to mention that as a student at the University of Ingolstadt, Frankenstein was inducted into the Société des Alchimistes by his chemistry professor. We have seen both their names, Victor Frankenstein and Adolf Waldmann, in the records of the society in Budapest. To find out how we were able to access those records, read the second in this series of Adventures of the Athena Club. Mary.
That's quite clever of you, actually, making them want to read the second book.
Frankenstein created Adam, as Mrs. Shelley describes. Then he created Justine. And this is where the biography becomes, as Mary calls it, a pack of lies. It concludes with an implausible and melodramatic chase across the Arctic, with Frankenstein pursuing the monster he created for revenge. Seriously, even I write more believable fiction than that. Those of you who have read the book will have noticed how different those chapters are from the earlier ones, which recount entire conversations verbatim and describe Frankenstein's experiments in detail. To understand her motivations, you have to understand the complicated woman who was Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley, only 19 years old when she started writing the biography. She was the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft, author of A Vindication of the Rights of Woman, and one of the few female members of the Société des Alchimistes at that time. She died when Mary was only a child, although we know that Mary identified with her mother and often read her writings. Mary's father, the political radical William Godwin, was also a member. Mary herself never became a member. We do not know why. Her husband, the poet Percy Shelley, was a member, as were Lord Byron and his friend Dr. John Polidori. Evidently, it was quite fashionable to be a member of the society in the early part of the century. It was not as secretive as it later became, and just scandalous enough to tempt men like Shelley and Byron. So, think of who was gathered at the Villa Diodati that summer in 1816, when Mrs. Shelley began work on the biography. Percy Shelley, Lord Byron, John Polidori, and Claire Claremont, Mary's stepsister, who was pregnant with Byron's child. About halfway through the summer, they were joined by Polidori's friend, Ernest Frankenstein, Victor's younger brother and the sole remaining member of the Frankenstein family. It was an unusually wet summer for Switzerland. Rain kept the inhabitants of the villa indoors. To pass the time, they told stories, and that was when Mrs. Shelley learned the details of Victor's life from Ernest himself. In the records of the society, there is a letter from Ernest to the president of that time. I record here a portion of it. Although you will scarcely credit it, Monsieur le Chevalier, the creature came to me himself to tell me of my brother's death in Scotland. He gloated over his vile crime, which I did not hesitate to call patricide, and vowed that he would revenge himself upon all the Frankensteins forever, and upon that she-creature my brother had so unadvisedly made for him. I told him that she was likely dead already, if not of drowning, then of exposure and starvation, and indeed I have heard nothing more of her. If I do, I will destroy her myself. Such an abomination should never have been allowed to walk the earth. It is bad enough that my brother created Adam, but that he would create an Eve, both stronger and more clever than man? That should never have been permitted. And if Waldmann had known, he would have brought the full wrath of the society down on my unfortunate and misguided brother's head. Ernest knew how his brother had died. He knew about Justine,
In that company, among members of the society sworn to secrecy, and Mary Shelley, daughter of trusted members, I believe he revealed the truth. So why did Mrs. Shelley write her book, and knowing the truth, why did she lie? It must have been in part to deflect attention from the society. If Adam appeared in Europe, he would be seen as the creation of a lone university student who had already paid the price for creating a monster. He would not be connected with the Société des Alchimistes. Mary, I told you so. But Mrs. Shelley also did something else. In her biography, Justine is never created. Frankenstein decides a female monster would be too dangerous and throws her body parts into the sea. Why did Mary Shelley never join the Société des Alchimistes? Because she was the daughter of Mary Wollstonecraft and the stepsister of Claire Claremont, whom Lord Byron was treating as a mistress he'd already tired of. He would later abandon her daughter Allegra, who died in a convent in Italy. She knew the truth, that Frankenstein had created a female monster, and that the female monster had escaped, and she hid that truth. Knowing of Justine, she did the best she could for another woman. She erased her from the story. Mary, that's highly speculative, you know. Catherine, but I'm convinced it's true. Look at the sympathy with which she wrote of Justine Moritz. That summer, Mary Shelley was only 19. She'd run away from home with Percy, who was already an acclaimed poet. She was in the home of the famous and scandalous Lord Byron, among men who were learned and powerful. And in their midst, she did something revolutionary. She allowed Justine to write her own story. Justine, I like to think it's true, and that in her own way Mary Shelley was also a sister to me. As I've written this book, I've sometimes wondered what she would have thought of us and our adventures, and of course the book itself. I think she would have excused its defects. Yes, Mary, I know there are some don't act so astonished. And praised it as an accurate portrayal of a group of women trying to get along in the world as best they can, like women anywhere, even if they are monsters. Sometimes I imagine her sitting in my room, in the chair by the window, as I write, marveling at the typewriter and how much faster it is than a quill pen. Whenever I'm not sure what to say, when the words don't come and I sit there staring at my notebook, she says something encouraging, one author to another. I swear, sometimes I can see the shadow she casts, and then I nod at the chair, as though she were really present, and get back to writing.
The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter was written by Theodora Goss and read by Kate Redding. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, Technical Director. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Strange Case of the Alchemist's Daughter is available in print from Saga Press.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.